Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, December 23rd. Avian flu doesn't really take a holiday. We hear from the U.S. Department of Agriculture about how it's tracking the avian influenza as it randomly checks on birds in the wild. We take a closer look at a survey of families displaced by the Maui wildfires, how the Filipino community fared immediately after the disaster. And how does a school recycling project lead to a snowball fight? We talked to a couple of Kau High School students about a recent trip to New York City. Plus, Jeff Peterson stops by our station to share some new holiday music. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The headlines across the country this past week include California declaring an emergency because of the spread of avian flu, as well as the first severe avian flu case in a human in Louisiana. And there is a move now to test raw milk in dairy farms. We connected with Juliana Lenock, who is the National Wildlife Disease Coordinator for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She's in charge of the surveillance programs across the country. We talked to her this morning from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hawaii's first positive test for avian flu came in November. Here's Lenock giving us the long view.
Our program, called the National Wildlife Disease Program, is responsible for disease surveillance and monitoring across the United States. And the disease, you know, the highest consequence disease right now on our plate is high-path avian influenza. We've been doing surveillance for avian influenza for about 19 years in kind of varying levels based on the risk and the prevalence worldwide. So this particular avian influenza outbreak that we're in right now in the United States, our first confirmed detections were in January of 2021. So we're almost 3 years into the outbreak, but the strain that's circulating in the United States hit Asia and Europe about a year, almost a year and a half before that. So globally, it's, you know, 4+ years into this current circulating strain, and it's now been detected on 6 continents, essentially everywhere except Oceania, you know, Europe and Asia first, into North America, then through Central and South America, and made its way to Antarctica in 23 and 2024. Only Australia and New Zealand area are free of disease at this point. Going back to the surveillance, this year we'll collect around 40,000 samples from the mainland United States, the 48 contiguous states, and Alaska. And then we allow opportunistic sampling in Hawaii and our other territories, Guam, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands. So we sort of set quotas for the main 48 and have a sampling schema for Alaska as well. And then specifically Hawaii has opportunities to send in, but we don't give a quota because there wasn't disease detected there before last month. Hawaii had remained disease-free until very recently.
Yes, it is alarming because, you know, we did have the wastewater sample test positive here on Oahu, and then a few weeks later tested positive on the Big Island. There's obviously some movement here, you know, because it's now in the wild. But how are you doing your surveillance?
Hawaii is a little bit of a special case. The big picture surveillance is done differently at different times of year and based on opportunities. It focuses on migratory waterfowl, dabbling ducks. Those are like mallards and pintails and teal. So we look at the populations of those birds and their expected migrations and movements. During the summertime, those will be live bird captures and in conjunction with sometimes other state agencies or federal agencies, sometimes with bird banding activities. And we sample the birds and they're released and, you know, continue on with their migration. In the fall, especially in the mainland United States, we rely on hunter harvest, so waterfowl duck hunters, and we sample subsets of those birds. When we look at the flyways and how birds normally migrate north and south and, you know, seasonally to their summer breeding grounds and their wintering grounds, we try to capture them across space and time to get, you know, a good scientific representation. If we are getting detections, which birds, where it might be going, if the virus is changing in any way, and communicate that as to our wildlife partners, our domestic bird, our poultry partners, and our human health counterparts if we're seeing any changes in the virus or methods of spread.
Because our geography probably makes it a little bit more challenging for the folks that are out there in the field. If I recall, that one duck that tested positive over at the James Campbell Wildlife Facility, I don't believe that duck had any symptoms, if I recall right. But it's really a little tricky then when you folks do the testing and then, you know, depending on when we get back those results.
Yes. Surveillance typically is done in apparently healthy birds. There are no signs that there's illness or spread going on. And a lot of the ducks are those silent carriers. They have the virus, they're spreading it, but there's no indication that they're sick. In contrast to that, we do have opportunities that's usually led by the state agency, but if it's on federal land or on tribal land, you know, other organizations could also be responsible. But if there's a wild bird mortality event where, you know, shorebirds or seabirds or sometimes ducks or geese populations, you know, we have seen this particular strain, this H5N1 high pass, has killed wild birds as well. And so sampling in symptomatic birds or dead birds is unfortunately a more efficient way to go because something has killed them. You know, so we have opportunities there. But most of the time in surveillance, we are looking at birds that appear 100% healthy. There's no indication that they're carrying the disease. And I think just the arrival to the Hawaiian Islands itself is of concern. The geographic separation protected Hawaii for a really long time. And we do continue to have high path avian influenza circulating in all of North America. We share information with our Canadian colleagues, and they have an excellent website up with their detections. Of course, we're adjacent to Canada, and anything that is in one of our countries is likely to move to the other one. So we share information very closely with our North American partners. But simply the arrival itself into Hawaii, special bird species there. We have seen this virus spill over into wild mammals. You've got some unique wild mammal populations also in Hawaii. We've seen reports both in the United States and globally of marine mammal mortality events in sea lions and different seal species. So working closely with NOAA Fisheries and our partners in Department of Commerce in case there's any spillover or anything we need to investigate on the marine mammal side. And then just kind of on a big global picture, getting to Hawaii does get it potentially a little bit closer to Australia and the other countries in so far untouched Oceania. So the global spread is of concern just in itself and the fact that we still have virus circulating in so many species.
You know, we've seen the headlines and the concern if it does, let's say, go into the wild pig population, because we have lots of wild pigs, feral pigs here in the mountains, because they harbor both avian flu viruses and other viruses that long-term, that could be a little bit scary. I mean, I heard a thing about, we're one pig away from, the next pandemic. And we just got done with COVID, and COVID is still around. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we've instituted surveillance in feral swine in the mainland United States and do not have any detections of avian influenza in our feral swine here, despite having pretty well-documented circulation, across the mainland. So at this point, we can say with confidence we don't have feral swine detections, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on. And we will work with our partners in Hawaii, in wildlife, and, within each of the specific island communities, that if there is a feral swine, anything of interest or of concern, we'll certainly work on sampling those. We work really closely right now with multiple, state and federal agencies. This is all hands on deck. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention is monitoring. The Department of Interior, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is monitoring. Each of the state wildlife agencies, agriculture agencies, and their departments of public health are working together. So it's been great. And as you mentioned, COVID, kind of the lessons learned and working together and sharing information faster, better, and, you know, more transparently has really been inspiring. It's rough that it's just, we have disease detection in all 50 states. So there is a lot of coordination happening. And we certainly want to stay tuned, especially because of the arrival right now into Hawaii, you know, both Oahu and your Big Island, that if there are wild bird mortality events, we want to investigate those. We want to make sure we're supporting the laboratories as much as possible, and they're able to get kind of quick turnaround. And again, kind of that coordination with the public health and the CDC folks, just so everyone has really strong situational awareness.
That was Juliana Lenuk, the National Coordinator of the Wildlife Surveillance Program under the U.S. Agriculture Department.
Tune into HPR 2 this Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony performs Tchaikovsky's Pathétique. Also featured mezzo-soprano Fleur Baron weaves a magical spell with Lieberson's Neruda songs. This special concert is dedicated to the memory of Michael Titterton, longtime president of HPR and later HSO. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
A group focusing on Filipinos in Lahaina recently released a report laying out the community's experiences and needs following the August 2023 wildfires. The report was shared last Sunday at an event at the Lahaina Civic Center. It featured 16 months of research on recovery, including one survey with nearly 800 responses from Filipino community members in the weeks following the fires. Nadine Ortega is the executive director of Tagnawa, the organization behind the report. After the fires, she found out she had Filipino relatives living in Lahaina. She connected with them, and their conversations inspired her to found this organization.
A lot of the stories that we heard were some of their distinct struggles with resource navigation, access to those resources, and eligibility to those resources. So, like my family, they were telling me that they didn't even know where to look for things. And some of them didn't, you know, weren't like tech savvy, for example, elderly, and they didn't know where to look for where the resource hubs were. And some of them didn't have the documentation required for certain things. I was also there at the founding of Roots Reborn Maui, and they were trying to help out the immigrant community. And I was helping out with translations because there weren't anybody, at least for those particular kinds of things that they were working on. It seemed like I was the only one helping out with the translations and posting on social media and all of that. So language was a barrier. We also heard from leaders of organizations on Maui on the ground at that time that there were elderly Filipinos who were being talked down to by FEMA officials because they couldn't understand. So what we hear at UH, a group of students, faculty, and community members began talking and saying, like, you know what, let's just go down there and figure out what Filipinos need. So that's kind of the beginning of that conversation and the action that came out of it. The original plan was to just go there and talk to some of the people that we know. And then it became this larger action of creating this community outreach day where we would go there. And first, in order to help and provide the right kind of help, is to find out what the people needed first from their own mouths. And so we adopted the needs assessment survey from Lahaina Strong, with their permission, of course, and translated into multiple Philippine languages. And then we went there, brought food from Oahu, pastries, and we blasted the event on social media. And that day that we got there, there were like 500 people in the lobby of the Royal Lahaina. And we were shocked because to us that confirmed that the like Filipinos, the Filipino survivors were really needing particular attention and they had needs that were unmet. So we were talking to them that day. They filled out our surveys and, you know, we found out a lot of things about our community, which we then compiled in this report that we just launched on Sunday.
Which things that you found out from that survey were affirming things that you already thought versus what came more as a surprise?
I think we already had a sense that, wait, there are some things, some needs of the Filipino community that are unmet. You know, we are essentially seen and treated as a labor source. And we are in the bottom of the social hierarchy in Hawaii. There's also research about health disparities. So the condition of Filipinos is not the best, right? And you throw in a disaster on top of that. And so that disaster exacerbates the conditions of Filipinos. And so we already knew that they are a particular vulnerable group and they would be during the recovery period as well. Some of the things that were shocking or that we didn't know ahead of time were we found out in the demographic findings that a huge portion of our community are elderly and with children. So when we thought about our approach to this problem is that not to think about Filipinos as all the same, as a monolith, this identity and community of Filipinos, there are even more vulnerable groups within it. So particularly elderly, women, mothers, immigrants who English as their second language, etc.
One of the things I found notable was what people responded with respect to children and school children. They cited a high level of distress, even saying in some cases that switching schools after the fires led to children experiencing bullying. So was that on your radar before these surveys?
We didn't know that particularly, but we did think about beforehand how this disaster would particularly affect mothers, elderly, kids. And it is concerning that, you know, the kids are experiencing displacement, bullying, and things like that at this particular time. And so we also do want to look more into that and also figure out solutions on how to address that problem. Because also I think that there is a lack of focus and attention on the children. I think when we think about disaster recovery, we really need to pay attention to different needs, or else it's going to be inequitable and there's going to be people that fall through the cracks. So I think there are things we can do now moving forward, knowing these things from the findings, possible ways that we can address that.
What do you hope comes from releasing this report?
I think about this report not as Tugnawa's or Hawaii Worker Center. I think about it as it's the community. It was just through us that we compiled it together, analyzed it, and published it. But it's really the community data. And what we hope from this report is for people to pay attention to this particular group. That, I mean, even in the report, what some of the community said, they feel a little bit invisibilized in the recovery process. Like there's a lack of consultation with the Filipino community. And I think this kind of brings their voices forward. Hey, let's consider this going forward in the community rebuilding and recovery process. We have a section on there on the recommendations and actionable steps. And it's not an exhaustive list. I think there's so much more. The recommendation section was dreamed up by survivors like Krishna Bayudan and Cheryl Alcantara, who are part of our writing team, these were some of the things that they were thinking about and dreaming about solutions for Lahaina, considering Filipinos. And that's just, I think, an initial recommendation. I think we invite people to think of more. Dream about a Lahaina that will allow Filipinos, Native Hawaiians, immigrants, and documented folks to thrive in Lahaina. Because the Lahaina that was there before didn't work for so many of our communities. And so those are just initial recommendations. And we invite people to think of more things. If there are no limitations, how do they envision a new Lahaina that works for everybody? And also, we are inviting lawmakers, policymakers, leaders of organizations to consider this report and think about how their practices moving forward, their policies that they create moving forward, can consider Filipinos and think of ways to approach disaster recovery in a more equitable way.
That was Nadine Ortega of Tuknawa talking about her new report with HPR's Maddie Bender. Tuknawa is an Ilocano word that expresses the idea of community coming together, its strength through unity. We'll have a link to that report on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Half the world's population voted in a national election in 2024. Mexico, India, the U.S., of course. But who could forget the contentious election in Venezuela?
There is a history in some Latin American countries for strongmen leaders to be seen as people who can fix things.
We'll talk about it all next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Kenyatta Kelechi Laulima, photographic images that examine concepts of indigenous identity and connection to family and place. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Christmas is right around the corner. This is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Now we've got your backyard quiz. One of our favorite holiday tunes on our playlist is Number One Day of Christmas, a local version of the classic, The 12 Days of Christmas. And as the story goes, Bob Magoon, Ed Kenny, and Gordon Phelps were hanging around in the living room of a Diamond Head home when the idea to write a Christmas song hit them. Fueled by a meal from Hee Hing Chop Suey, the three friends hammered out the song that we all know and love in about 15 minutes. For today's backyard quiz, we're going to test your lyrical abilities. Listen close. We're going to play a snippet from the classic Ode to Tutu, and the first listener to call and finish the verse is the winner. Ready, set, go!
Number five day of Christmas, my tutu gave to me 5 big fat
Okay, got it? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689. Sing us the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Thank you.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
A group of Ka'u High School students recently made a trip to New York City to give a presentation at the National Recycling Congress. They shared information about their school's new zero waste program, the Hawaii Youth Clean Stream Campaign and Waste to Wealth Initiative. The first phase of the program aims to divert cafeteria food waste from the landfill. For some of the group, it was their first trip to a big city. HPR's Russell Subiano talked to senior Yuri Noel Soriano and junior Kona Smith, as well as teacher Ulu Makuakane, about the Zero Waste program and their experience in the Big Apple.
So in the beginning of our program, we started a waste diversion in our school's cafeteria, where we diverted all of the food waste, paper waste, and of course, plastics into separate bins. And so over the time from October 16th through us going to New York in November, we were collecting data. And this is what we also presented at the NRC conference. They also talked about the program, what they're about, what they do during class time. And one of the perks of this program is that our students do get to be employees and get paid. And so they also shared their experience about that and sort of just all the opportunities that they've been able to go through. And that's what they presented, along with cultural aspects like doing an oli to get centered and grounded before presenting. They wear their kihei as well, that showcased a design that they created using natural materials. But yeah, the purpose was just to go and share their mana'o and the ike that they've learned so far.
I read that the students were the stars of the conference. Is that true? How did they capture the spotlight?
I think anywhere you go, especially if you're from Hawaii and you travel, you know, to a place that's maybe unfamiliar or those that are unfamiliar with the culture of Hawaii, you definitely, you know, create attention towards the group. So it's just the word that I can think of is just their ano, like just their characteristics and how they presented themselves and how they interacted with the attendees and participants there. I felt like really set their group apart. And yeah, I guess showing that aloha to everybody there.
Yuri, I've read a little bit about the school's program, the Hawaii Youth Clean Stream Campaign and Waste to Wealth Initiative. From what I can tell, it aims to reduce landfill waste on Hawaii Island while empowering youth-led community action. Can you talk about how the program works?
Okay, so we basically just stay in our stations and watch and observe how other students are with like throwing stuff away. And sometimes like you'll get students who'll just throw away their food along with their trash in the same bin. And it's usually because they want to like rush on out of the cafeteria. But we stopped them and we're like, hey, can you separate those? Can you like do better next time? I believe that it like helps students to like see like how other students like do their part and separating the food from their trash. And it's just like a chain reaction, you know?
That's awesome. So the students that are in the program, they'll keep an eye on where students are disposing of their waste in the cafeteria. And basically you guys are getting the students to keeping them separate, right? Putting food waste in one, the other waste in the other, right?
Yes.
Okay. This question is for Kona. I've been told that that diversion program, that it's diverted over a ton of food waste from the landfill. How have you seen that and any other zero waste work you and your fellow students are doing impact your community?
I feel like it really did change the students' mindset on things, like how they have to separate stuff, mm-hmm. behavioral-wise, because before they used to just dump their plates in trash. into any trash can. And so it would just be piles and piles of waste and food waste mixed together. And so basically, I feel like now since that program has started, everything has changed. It's more cleaner and it's better for our community because it helps to reduce the amount of waste, like you just said.
And so what you're seeing is a change in behavior and a change in mindset. And so the program that you guys are instituting, you're starting to see a change in the way that students view waste and maybe treat waste as well. Is that kind of how you see it?
Yes.
Ulu, this question is for you. Why is it important for students from Ka'u High School to learn through this initiative? How does it benefit them, whether they decide to remain in Ka'u after graduation or test the waters of the world outside the community?
So yeah, being from rural Ka'u myself, and my family has been here for, multi-generations. And so I've definitely seen a shift in our community, both positively and negatively. I think a lot of us growing up here think that we have to move away and go out and, go find opportunities elsewhere. And one of the purposes of this program is to show our Haumana students that there are careers in this field, like the program that they're doing, that you can utilize what you're learning and your trainings and all of that and put it back into the community and be of service to our Kaiaulu and our community members. Also providing education and, like Haukana was talking about, behavioral change. This is my personal opinion, but I feel like from influences of westernization and colonization and all of that, we have sort of just become used to just like throwing things away, and faster is, convenience is better. But definitely at the NRC, our students were able to connect with young professionals in college that are, aiming to be in this field, and the opportunities that are provided through, going into this. So it's a huge benefit for our students to just see and open their eyes that they can do this professionally and, support themselves and their families and give back to their communities as well.
Yuri, I heard that the students that went to New York got to go on a tour of New York City, which to me seems like kind of the polar opposite of small town Ka'u. How did this trip to New York impact what you believe is in the realm of possibility for your life after graduation?
So when I was done in New York, I saw a lot of factories, a lot of people, and it was like extremely different from Ka'u, like with all the tall buildings. But what really concerned me was the people and their attitudes. And the factories, it's just sad how New York City was once just land, no buildings at all. And if I'm not mistaken, New York City is one of the worst in pollution and stuff like that. And down in Ka'u, it's just all natural. It was definitely a culture shock. As a child, I always planned on living in the city, but now I feel like that's not the best idea, especially with the amount of time we have left to like save the planet and whatever. And I know a lot of people like don't believe in climate change. They think it's a hoax. So yeah, I really don't want to visit the city anytime soon. It's just like fascinating how upsetting it was being there. And I feel like we should create laws. And I know there are some laws, but some laws aren't enough to like save the future generations of our children and stuff like that.
Do you feel that the trip and your experience in New York, do you feel it maybe changed how you perceive your own hometown?
Extremely. I used to not be fond of living here, honestly, because I always dreamt of the city, like that. And now it's just, I want to stay down here. keep it all natural and stuff like that.
Kona, I read that your trip to the conference in New York was extended by a couple of days because of a snowstorm. I heard that you guys took full advantage of the weather, got into some snowball fights. Can you talk about the highlights of the trip for you and maybe the biggest thing that you learned while on the trip?
Well, the biggest highlight was when the people were telling their stories, especially with the Louisiana people. When they told their story, it made me realize that here in Hawaii, since we are kind of a small island, but a big island, you know what I mean? The community, we just come together, we help one another, but it's not the same as it is for them. They don't really have as much support as we do. They don't really have the support that they need, like how we have. And this was one of the key things for me because they told me stories about how they would go out into the community and they would tell people about all these problems that the factories are causing. And people would just turn a blind eye to it. They wouldn't even do that, or the company's doing something to the community. And it really made me upset because it's your community. You're supposed to be taking care of your community because it's like your ohana.
Those were really all the questions that I had for you guys. How was that snowball fight? I mean,
we got them. We got them good. Me and Auntie Lulu guys, we made up a plan to sneak attack the boys. And it was really fun to experience the snow for the first time. It was cold, but yeah. Fun.
Well, Ulu, Yuri, Kona, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
We were hearing from Ka'u High School students, Kona Smith and Yuri Noel Soriano, and their teacher, Ulu Makuakane. They were talking to HPR's Russell Subiono about a recent trip they took to New York City to give a presentation to the National Recycling Congress.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Outrigger Resorts and Hotels, featuring the sights and sounds of beaches throughout the islands, live music, and cultural experiences. Learn more at outrigger.com.
Imagine growing up as the son of the most famous alien in the world.
I would have a knockdown, drag-out argument with my dad, and then I would go to pick up my shirts at the cleaners, and the guy would figure out my last name and wax eloquently about how much he loves Spock, and I'm like, yada, 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 can I just get my shirts?
Adam Nimoy on his father, Leonard Nimoy, and what it was like growing up as the son of Mr. Spock. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Well, now it's time to sing you the answer to today's backyard quiz. Mauna Kea experienced the year's first snowfall in late October, and the seasonal winter Kona low system will continue through the new year. If the weather repeats from last year, it could very well be a white Christmas on the summits of Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa. But back here at sea level, we've been getting into the holiday spirit by delving into our music library of local favorites. This morning, we quizzed you about the gifts that Tutu gives in the local holiday song, Number One Day of Christmas. We're looking for what she shared on the fourth day, Mele Kalikimaka. And congrats to our winners, Sun Chunde of Pearl City, our HPR sustaining member. She had the fastest fingers and sang us the right answer. That was our quiz, and if you have one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Oh, and what did Tutu give out on the fourth day?
Four flower lilies, two dry squid, two coconuts, and one minor bird in one papaya tree. And one minor bird in one papaya.
Well, you know, we're really in the mood, and we have a treat for you this morning. We were honored to have Slack Key Master Jeff Peterson in our studios last week. He has a new album out, a lovely collection of instrumental Christmas music that touches deep in your soul during the holiday season. Peterson has been quite busy touring the world this year, and we were fortunate that he found time to share his gift with us.
I've wanted to do this album for many years, and I've played on compilations of other albums, and I've worked with Amy Hanaili'i and helped to arrange a lot of the music and played on her Hawaiian Christmas album a few years back. And I've been wanting to do my own Kihu'alu style Christmas album for a long time. I finally did it. It was a lot of fun to work on.
Yeah, and you managed to do this album in between all your tours, and you had a chance to go to Bhutan.
Yeah, I've been doing a program with Kiola Beamer. It started actually about 10 years ago in 2014 through the U.S. State Department. We applied for a program called American Music Abroad, and we're the first group from Hawaii to be chosen to represent the U.S. and go to different countries, but actually really being ambassadors for Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian music. Also, and hula, because Moanalani Beamer accompanied us on the trip. So the three of us went out. We went to Venezuela, Brazil, Colombia, Zimbabwe, Africa. But then we wanted to have more of a direct, we did a lot of outreach programs with students, but we wanted to actually bring instruments. So we started our own organization through the Mohala Ho Foundation, which is Kiola Beamer's nonprofit. And it's called the World Ukulele Project. And I think the ukulele brings so much happiness around the world. It brings children together. It brings families and communities together. It's been amazing to see the impact. So we raise money, and we bring about 40 or 50 instruments. And so far, we've been to Cambodia, Sikkim, which is another country that's in between Bhutan and Nepal in the Himalayan plateau, and then most recently to Bhutan. And the students we worked with have very few resources, and so for them to have their own instruments, it's absolutely amazing and inspiring for them. I spend a week teaching them, and we do collectively, then we present a concert after the lessons. But then I continue. I do a lot of online teaching. I have a website called Ukulele Corner. And so I keep sending resources to their teachers. And the thing that we found that really makes the program work is having great teachers who are responsive and I can keep in touch with over time. And so it's so much fun to see. We get videos now of the students performing and doing public concerts. They're inspiring other children to want to play music. We're not going with the goal of teaching any style of music, but just the basics of playing the ukulele, playing melodies and chords. And then I always try to learn some of the traditional music from the areas that we're going to have a connection and a way to communicate with the students. And then we just let them go and do their thing. And it's really fun to see some become songwriters. They develop ensemble music, and you know, many are great singers.
Yeah, well, I'm just curious. I don't know, when you were there with the kids, you know, performing, did you play any of the songs on your album?
I didn't play any of the Christmas songs, but when I have been touring, I did, right when the album came out, I did a month-long tour with Led Ka'apana and George Kahumoku, and I played Ave Maria and Hallelujah, because it was in September, mm-hmm. So it was right before the holidays, a little too early, but that song I've been playing quite a bit. And I played one highlight of that tour. We played at the oldest chapel in the United States. It's the San Miguel Chapel in Santa Fe. It's built in 1610, still standing, adobe brick building. It's right in the heart of Santa Fe. And it was really inspiring to play that piece there at that chapel.
Oh, what were the acoustics like?
So beautiful. Yeah, yeah. It just sounds like the guitar just got bigger, not amplified, but just, you know, just full. So, but I've been playing a lot of holiday concerts, and during the pandemic, I started doing live concerts from my living room every Wednesday. So Hawaii time right now, this time of year, it's 3 p.m. and I play on a platform called Crowdcast. And every week I try to put together a new program. So I keep Wednesdays wide open and I just practice like crazy all day, getting ready, writing music, arranging, and working on new things. And so I really enjoy presenting music there. And I continue to do it when I can, traveling as well. If I have a free Wednesday and the timing works out, I can just jump online and do a show.
Have you gotten sucked into TikTok?
I haven't gotten into it. I should, yeah. I do. I still do Facebook and Instagram, and Jeff Peterson Guitar is my website. I do a lot through there. But the main thing, actually, I've found to help students, especially with the Ukulele Corner website and my Slack Key Guitar website, is YouTube. And so I've created many, many lessons, and I present them on, there's a Ukulele Corner channel on YouTube, and then I have the Jeff Peterson Guitar channel as well for Slack Key. What I've been trying to do, when I grew up on Maui, I came from Haleakala Ranch, and I heard a lot of Slack Key and Hawaiian music, but no one wanted to teach. It was really frustrating. I was so eager to learn, but everyone was too busy and they weren't teachers. So I learned by ear. But what I've been doing for nearly 20 years now, maybe even a little longer, is just trying to create teaching resources for the tradition to continue. And so I have now on the website, there must be about 400 or so lessons, video lessons with sheet music and everything.
Wow. So what you didn't have, you have now provided.
Yeah, that's been my goal for sure, so that the resources are there. And I've learned a lot in the process. It's been really fun to do. I've published for Ukulele Corner, for the ukulele, I've published 7 books now, a classical repertoire. I've been arranging pieces from the Renaissance era up to modern day for solo ukulele. I've published a Hawaiian book, a book on baritone ukulele, practice routines, a Christmas book, and music of a great classical composer from, he was a Spanish composer. He lived in Vienna for a long time in Paris, Fernando Sor. So his repertoire for ukulele, I've done a book as well.
Interesting. You know, as you go to all these places around the globe, do you get inspired then to create unusual things just based on the geography and where you're at, like in Bhutan? I mean, I don't know, did it become your muse in a way?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I love writing music while touring and traveling, absolutely. And I have so many memories that continue to inspire me. I took a ukulele, too heavy to carry a guitar, but we hiked from to Tiger's Nest, and you started about 10,000 elevation, 10,000 feet, which is, you know, like the top of Haleakala, and you go up a switchback about 2,000 more feet, up to 12,000 feet. But I brought a ukulele and played overlooking the monastery. It was really inspiring and fun. I played a prayer song, a Buddhist prayer song that I learned from a friend of mine, Ben Verdery, who's been the head of the Yale guitar program for years, but his wife has ohana here on Oahu. He's just retiring and he's moving. So it's going to be exciting for the guitar community. This one of the legendary, you know, teachers and classical guitarists is going to be moving to Oahu soon.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, do you think you could share some of your music with our listeners since we're getting into the holiday spirit?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So let's hear the Ave Maria Hallelujah rendition.
Yeah, I brought my Goodall guitar made by James Goodall. He was, it's one of the last he built in Kona, a wonderful builder. And this is the guitar that I use on the recording as well.
Thank you. beautiful is that? Private concert with Jeff Peterson.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, it's an honor. Thank you for all you do for the community.
Oh, gosh. Well, everybody, happy holidays and God bless. Does it for us today. Tomorrow, we hear about a new film about the Nisei legacy that makes its premiere next week, Ashigata Ganai, which means it can't be helped. All about acceptance and moving on. Have a holiday blessing you'd like to share? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.